This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There's a new guy at the Labor Department. What's up on Wall Street and why? And we'll do a little bit of ambulance chasing on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 16th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So that didn't take long, did it? Less than 24 hours after Andy Puzder withdrew as the nominee to be Secretary of Labor, President Trump announced his new pick at a press conference in Washington today. R. Alexander Acosta is his name. The R stands for Renee, should you be curious. Mr. Acosta is formerly of the National Labor Relations Board, the Department of Justice, and most recently the Dean's Office at the Law School at Florida International University. Many things that Mr. Puzder was not, which, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, has labor people cautiously optimistic.
Labor activists were really, really freaked out about having Andy Puzder as labor secretary, so many were sighing with relief today following Trump's pick of Alex Acosta. Patricia Campos Medina is with the Worker Institute at Cornell University.
But he seems to be a more middle-of-the-road Bush conservative with the right credentials and the right experience.
Acosta is considered a much safer candidate for the Trump administration, says Judy Conti of the National Employment Law Project.
Somebody somewhere has convinced the Trump administration that it is not worth a huge, messy fight over the Secretary of Labor.
She expects Acosta to have a relatively easy confirmation, but labor rights groups already worked into a frenzy over Puzder are diving into his record.
Well, they'll certainly be looking at the decisions that he penned and joined at the National Labor Relations Board to see if there is a tilt one way or the other to the union or to the employer.
Unlike Puzder, Acosta doesn't seem to have as public or controversial a record on labor issues. Andrew Stettner of the Century Foundation doubts there will be any deal breakers.
And Mr. Acosta is someone who has an appreciation of the rule of law, certainly someone who's conservative, but someone who has been respected as someone who takes a more balanced view.
But it's unlikely in this political climate that Democrats or activists will give any Trump pick the benefit of the doubt. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Once upon a time, in days that somehow seem very, very long ago, a North Korean missile launch, then a Russian spy boat, and a resigned national security advisor, and a disastrously rolled out executive order might have done a bit of a number on Wall Street. You know, just a bit. But despite all that, the markets are doing pretty well. Thanks. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what is going on Wall Street.
This is what you call a bull market. Willie Delwich is an investment strategist at Robert W. Baird.
We've got the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Dow, each making new all-time highs, you know, every day for the past 5 days, which is something we haven't seen in, I believe, a quarter of a century.
Now, some of this is tied to Donald Trump's campaign promises. John Stolfus is chief investment strategist with Oppenheimer Asset Management.
Lower taxes, less regulation, and a large infrastructure spend.
Lower taxes, by the way, means more corporate profit, means higher stock prices. But what about the whole constant, relentless stream of things hitting the fan in Washington?
Most of the chaos surrounds foreign policy.
Steve Blitz is an independent economist and longtime market watcher.
And nothing really is chaotic, at the moment at least, about this planned domestic agenda in terms of the economy.
Both Paul Ryan and President Trump today insisted tax reform is coming. But the real story here isn't in Washington or court battles or national security advisors. It's in the numbers. Richard DeKayser is corporate economist with Wells Fargo & Company.
A couple of weeks ago, we learned that in the month of January, payrolls increased almost a quarter of a million jobs for the private sector. That was way above expectations. Inflation has beaten expectations. Retail sales have beaten expectations.
Could something happen that could wreck Wall Street's party? Oh, yeah. But for now, the numbers are carrying the day. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Defense Secretary James Mattis was in Brussels this week, meeting with defense ministers from the 28 NATO member countries, meetings in which Mattis said, and I'm paraphrasing here, y'all need to pay your fair share or we are going to rethink this whole common defense thing. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
How much should NATO members spend on defense? The question isn't new. What is the United States' approach to getting allies to spend more? Charles Kupchin is a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and former special national security assistant to President Obama.
The Obama administration generally relied on encouragement and arm twisting. The Trump administration seems more inclined to rely on threat. You better spend 2% of GDP on defense or else.
That 2% is a goal, not a requirement. Of the alliance's 28 members, only 5 spend that. Poland, Britain, Estonia, Greece, and the United States, which spends about 3.5%. Europe's biggest economy, Germany, spends just 1.2%. Daniel Kochis is with the Heritage Foundation.
It's very disheartening. Clearly, Germany is not where it should be and needs to be. And I think even their defense minister recently acknowledged that.
European nations tend to spend more on things like healthcare and unemployment benefits and less on defense. That's a problem for the U.S., says Nora Bensahel. She's a military analyst at American University.
You know, the question was, should the United States keep, you know, continuing to support NATO in a strong and vibrant way, given that you could accuse the NATO allies of free riding?
But with Russia's annexation of Crimea and the ongoing threat from ISIS, some believe the issue isn't how much individual nations pay, but whether NATO's overall budget is big enough. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Traders took a breather from the rally today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Aluminum is the marketplace commodity of choice this week. It's a heavy industry that helped build the American middle class. Good, solid jobs that you could get with a high school diploma. But globalization and cheap Chinese aluminum have hollowed out the domestic industry. And a little bit over a year ago, Alcoa announced it was going to shut down several of its smelters and lay off more than 1,000 of its remaining workers. Yesterday, Mitchell Hartman took us to Messina, New York, where 600 smelter jobs had been saved for a while, anyway, with millions of dollars in state incentives. Today, he goes to Wenatchee, Washington, where local aluminum workers weren't quite so lucky. Here's Mitchell.
The Columbia River carves its way through rocky gorges and valleys of apple orchards on its way to Wenatchee, a small city in central Washington at the foot of the Cascade Mountains. There's a Depression-era hydroelectric dam, and right next to it, Alcoa's idled aluminum smelter. The company shut down production last January. 420 workers lost their jobs.
We worked our tails off. Yeah, I didn't think there was any chance of them shutting that old place down, but...
That's Josh Musgrove, who's taking an auto mechanics class with other laid-off Alcoa workers at the local community college, part of their government-sponsored worker retraining program. Musgrove got a job at Alcoa right out of high school, just like previous generations.
My father-in-law, he was there for darn near 40 years. That was life. That was his whole family.
And the money was good for this rural area, around $25 an hour, plus union health and pension benefits. Josh Bujon is also laid off and taking the auto shop class. He's got small kids.
Cut my budget in half, and if you're stuck in, like, say, a rental, and it's more than you can afford now, yeah, there's nothing for that.
Over at the Aluminum Trades Council Hall, union president Kelly Woodard says working in a smelter, it's hard.
Rotating shifts, it's hot, nasty, not one weekend off than the month, but it definitely paid well.
Well enough to buy a house, take nice vacations, put kids through college.
We're not talking about retail or something where you're making 10 bucks an hour. You're talking jobs that people are making six figures, a lot of them.
When Woodard started more than 30 years ago, there were about 20,000 aluminum smelter workers nationwide. Today, the Steelworkers Union says there are just 2,200. And laid-off Alcoa workers Bujon and Musgrove say they've lost more than just their jobs.
I won't be able to do anything as big and unique and dangerous as working at Alcoa was.
One of the things that I miss the most is the guys I work with. Yeah, you kind of almost build like a relationship with everybody. Everybody else kind of looks after each other.
Bob Greiner is the auto instructor for the retraining class Bujon and Musgrove are taking. He predicts these men will get back on their feet. There's plenty of work for mechanics, though they may have to leave town to find it.
They've been phenomenal students, punctual. You know, they're on top of the assignments. Definitely tell that they've came from industry and they're looking to start anew.
Unemployment here is higher than the state average at 6.3%. Even so, Wenatchee seems to be faring pretty well economically. Its population's growing, so there's work in construction. High tech and agriculture are doing well. And there's a bit of nightlife, especially for Trivia Tuesdays at the Saddle Rock Brewery.
In 1841, this president delivered the longest inaugural address to date.
Where I met retiree Margaret Malampy, a recent transplant to Wenatchee.
Real estate is booming. Is there a lot to do if you're an outdoors person? Absolutely, yeah.
So that's tourism and recreation jobs, too. Over at McGlynn's Public House, bar and restaurant manager Sarah Barkley says her business has held up okay since the layoffs, though most people here know someone who's lost an Alcoa job.
It's a small town. People grow up here and they stay here. So what happens when you can't make a living here anymore?
Alcoa didn't make anyone available for an interview about its future plans for its smelters in Messina or Wenatchee. In an email, the company said it continues to monitor market conditions. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're going to take a minute here for our Every Now and Then series about how people are getting by. It's called My Economy. You send us your stories. We put them on the radio. Today's dispatch comes to us from Clinton, Washington, and an unlikely member of what has come to be called the gig economy.
My name is Tom Trembath. I was an engineer at Boeing for 18 years. I was always working with commercial airplanes or commercial rockets or commercial satellites. I decided to make the turn when I found I could retire at 38, which was a nice thing to have happen. It was actually happening at a time when there were cutbacks, and I was sitting there at work, and I knew that I had enough to live my frugal lifestyle. And I was watching all these young families, and they're trying to figure out if they're going to make it through the layoffs, and it just felt like I couldn't stay there. When the recession hit, happened to be when I lost a lot, and that's when I had to scramble to find out some other way to kind of, you know, all of a sudden pay a lot of bills. Was the hardest time to then just step back into a regular full-time job because there weren't any. The gig economy is usually associated with millennials. Almost everybody that I know in the gig economy is the parents of the millennials, because it's that hard to get full-time jobs anymore. Throughout the years, I've been trying to get back into an engineering job because they pay really well and they really enjoy the work. I mean, it's really neat to kind of make things fly, literally. What I found is this is actually an expensive way to work. I can pay for almost all my bills with all this work, but not quite. I can either pay for everything except income tax, or pay for everything except health insurance.
Tom Trembath there. We got him in Clinton, Washington. You can tell us your story at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
how can I help prevent the 911 call?
Interesting thing for an ambulance guy to say, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Tiny gain for the blue chips today, 7 points on the Dow, up just a fraction, closed at 20,619. NASDAQ down 4 points, also a fraction, 5814. S&P 500 down 2 points. That is even less than a fraction, really, 2347. Earlier, we learned about the president's new pick for labor secretary. Tomorrow, Mr. Trump makes a trip to Boeing's plant in South Carolina, where workers overwhelmingly voted Wednesday to reject an offer to unionize. Boeing ended things up 0.8%. Raytheon up 0.2%. Kate Spade says it's taken a look at its strategic options. It posted higher revenue and profit in the fourth quarter, even though handbag sales were down. But it was in the bag for Kate Spade today, finishing up 14.7%. I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in Capitalism is Amazing. This item, Snap, the parent company of Snapchat, has made a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission that will value the company once it goes public somewhere between $16 and $18.5 billion. Not quite as high as people had been guessing, but still a tidy sum for a company that's only 5 years old and employs just 330 people. Valuation is the term of art for that, a number based not on Snap's present, but its future, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Even on the low end of the expected valuation range, Snap's IPO is expected to be the largest U.S.-listed tech offering since the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba in 2014. So why is Snap worth so much? Normally, this is what you'd look at.
Revenue growth, profit margin, trends, cash flow.
Brian Weiser is an analyst at Pivotal Research. The case of Snap, he says, underscores one really big difference between old and new economy stocks.
Where the profit margin profile is impossible to assess, and where investors will have widely diverging views on how risky the cash flows will be.
What Snap does have going for it is 158 million daily users, which allows it to monetize that user base through advertising. But gauging how high that growth will reach is a really hard question, says Jitendra Warrell, an analyst with Bloomberg LP.
You know, everything needs to go right. So there's execution risk. So if they mess up on the execution, that growth rate that people are expecting might not come through, and then we have a problem.
Even though Snap has been a success so far, it still hasn't turned a profit, and it would be wrong, Warrell says, to expect Facebook-like profitability out of the gate.
Yes, Facebook is a great reference point, but then if you look at things like Zynga, Groupon, Twitter, you know, they've burned their fingers.
Another X factor for Snap is the fact that there haven't been very many big IPOs lately, which means there's lots of cash in investors' pockets. Snap shares could be priced as soon as March 1st and begin trading on the following day. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Fed Chair Janet Yellen spent the last 2 days on Capitol Hill, as you might know, answering various and sundry questions from members of Congress about interest rates and the labor market and banking regulations, Dodd-Frank in particular. President Trump has said he wants to roll back much of that law. And in a handy reminder that when we say banks, we don't just mean the biggies on Wall Street. The smaller regional banks have honed in on one key part of Dodd-Frank that they would like to see go away. The bit about how big a bank has to be for it to be considered too big to fail. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
You remember Too Big to Fail, those financial institutions that were so big that when they folded, they helped cause the financial crisis. Dodd-Frank says any bank with $50 billion or more in assets is too big to fail. These financial institutions are more tightly regulated. Some smaller banks that have just slightly more than $50 billion in assets want that threshold raised. They say they're struggling to comply with the increased regulation. But not everybody thinks the threshold needs to be higher.
Both big banks and community banks are making literally record profits.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren during Yellen's testimony this week. Warren says banks are thriving under the Dodd-Frank rules.
Well, I wouldn't say thriving.
That's Paul Mirsky of Independent Community Bankers of America. He's been lobbying furiously, trying to convince members of Congress to raise the $50 billion threshold for too big to fail. Mirsky says smaller banks are actually merging, partly so they have the staff and resources to comply.
Well, the higher the cost of regulation, the larger the bank would want to become to spread out that cost.
But Michael Barr says those banks would have merged anyway. He's a former assistant treasury secretary who helped write Dodd-Frank and is now at the University of Michigan. He says the too big to fail rule is graduated, so it's not that tough on smaller banks. But he says regulators can't ignore the smaller banks.
It would be a mistake to go to an approach that says we're not really going to explore whether there are risks elsewhere in the system. We're only going to look at the top handful of firms in the economy.
There could be a compromise here, says Ann Owen, a former Fed economist now at Hamilton College.
The regulators would have to go in and look more at how much risk this institution was taking and the nature of the business, and that it wouldn't be, oh, once you reach this threshold, you're classified as systemically important.
Owen says it makes sense to have some middle ground here, but middle ground is in short supply right now in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
At his press conference today, President Trump promised to unveil his replacement for Obamacare by early to mid-March. And then Congress is going to do whatever it is that Congress is going to do. But in the meanwhile, the health care economy keeps grinding along. In Fort Worth, Texas, ambulance and paramedic companies are doing something interesting. Usually, those businesses have to have sirens blaring to make money. That is, getting people to the hospital. In Fort Worth, though, some emergency medical companies are doing just the opposite, scheduling their visits to treat patients in their homes. Mobile integrated healthcare is called, as KERA's Lauren Silverman explains.
For more than a decade, John Farish traveled through the streets of Fort Worth, trying to save people at the brink of death. And he couldn't help but wonder,
how can I help prevent the 911 call?
This is a question that went against the very business model of the ambulance company he works for, MedStar, until recently. A question most EMS companies don't talk about, because the more trips to the hospital, the more money ambulance services make. But it still mattered to Ferris. So sometimes after stabilizing a patient in the back of the ambulance, he'd try and squeeze in a conversation about nutrition or hydration. He'd be lucky if he got 10 minutes to offer advice for staying out of the ER. Now, he gets a full hour with five patients each day.
What kind of car are we jumping in?
This is a Chevy Malibu.
Ferris is what's called a community paramedic. It's his job to see the trickiest patients, those who keep landing back in the ER and are readmitted to the hospital. Since the Affordable Care Act, the government penalizes hospitals for excessive readmissions, costing hospitals across the country hundreds of millions of dollars. Today's second stop is at Sandra Guevara's apartment in Fort Worth. It's dark and the black curtains are closed. Guevara, who's in her early 30s, gets her blood pressure taken on the couch. Last year, Guevara went to the emergency department more than 20 times, occasionally needing a ventilator to breathe.
My asthma's been going on since I was 14 years old.
Guevara is on Medicaid, so she generally doesn't have to pay the $1,000-plus each visit might cost. But those visits are something the government, hospitals, and especially Guevara want to avoid.
I don't like going to the ER. And especially when they put me in a little bitty room, I'll literally start crying and I'll start shaking and everything because I can't deal with it.
From our perspective in the emergency setting, we look at it and go, this is just a non-compliant patient that doesn't want to listen to us.
John Ferris says if you spend time with Guevara, you learn.
That's not the case. The mental health needs that she has tied in with her asthma, tied in with her allergic asthma, all of it together is combining factors to make her worse. And every time that she's went out of the hospital, she was back in a couple of days.
Ferris has helped Guevara modify her diet and consistently take her medication. He's also made sure her doctors know what's going on and connected her to a psychiatrist. When MedStar started enrolling patients for its mobile integrated healthcare program in 2009, it was one of the first in the country. Today, there are more than 260 similar programs nationwide.
Some programs are actually showing decreases of 80 to 90% readmission.
Dr. Darren D'Agostino is Associate Dean of Community Medicine at UNT Health Science Center. He says early studies show pairing frequent hospital users with community paramedics can save money in the long run. For example, MedStar saved $17,000 per patient over a three-year period. The challenge is securing initial funding. Remember, right now, most emergency services are paid for ferrying patients to the hospital.
So what that's done is actually helped focus many of the programs on partnerships to allow for payment.
Since MedStar's community paramedicine program is paid for by hospitals and health providers trying to save costs, it's not clear if it would be affected by changes to the Affordable Care Act. The company is counting on a continued focus on the quality of care and cost cutting, no matter what happens with the ACA. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick cut from pretty early, actually, in the president's unusual press conference today.
To be honest, I inherited a mess. It's a mess. At home and abroad, a mess. Jobs are pouring out of the country. You see what's going on with all of the companies leaving our country, going to Mexico and other places. Low pay, low wages.
One of the rules of this program is that context matters, and without taking anything at all away from the real challenges Mr. Trump faces overseas, it does have to be noted here for the record that the economy added 227,000 jobs last month, that the unemployment rate is 4.8%, that wages are rising at their fastest pace in years, and that just yesterday we learned inflation is a very solid and Janet Yellen-pleasing 2.5%, because context matters. We're just going to say it was kind of meh on Wall Street today. Everything changed just a fraction up and down. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.